Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Around the world with reporters.
The Palestinian leadership has praised the International Criminal Court for its ruling that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories, allowing its chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, to investigate Israeli atrocities, despite fierce objections from Tel Aviv. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Ishtayi said the decision is a victory for justice, humanity, and freedom, and for the blood of the victims, namely the Palestinians and their families. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also praised the ruling and said it's ready to cooperate with the ICC's prosecutor if an investigation is launched.
We urge the International Court and its chief prosecutor to immediately launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes against the Palestinian people. We have already filed several legal complaints against Israel with the ICC. We are now ready to carry out every possible effort to see Israeli military officials and settlers being prosecuted for their crimes.
The ICC's ruling, however, has angered the Israeli regime, as its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed the ruling as a political tribunal, accusing the ICC for being a political body and not a legal institution. Israel has not joined the International Criminal Court, but the Palestinian Authority is a signatory since 2015. This means the ICC's mandate is to prosecute people, not countries, including those from states that are not signatories, and in this case, Israeli leaders, military officials, and soldiers who are accused of carrying out crimes against Palestinians.
I doubt that that will make such a difference in Israel, because if we know the nature of Israel and it's based on violence, based on the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and grabbing the land of Palestine, because of that, I don't think that will make a big difference for the Israeli policies in the region.
The Palestinians have asked the court to look into Israeli crimes during its 2014 war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as Israel's construction of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The ICC's decision paves the way for the tribunal's prosecutor to open a war crime investigation. But the main question lingering in mind is that will the U.S., which has furiously condemned the court, allow prosecution of Israeli officials and forces over their crimes committed in the Palestinian territories? Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there is a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks.
The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population.
U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients through testing before entering Korea, and more thorough management measures should be implemented not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
The International Criminal Court has ruled that it has jurisdiction to examine possible Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a statement, the court announced that it has decided by majority that its territorial jurisdiction in the situation in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Quds. The ICC's decision has been praised by Palestinians, with Prime Minister Mohammad Shatayeh calling it a victory for justice.
The resolution is a message to the perpetrators of crimes that their crimes will not be subject to statutes of limitations and that they will not go unpunished.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also called the ruling a historic day for the principle of accountability, and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged the court to investigate the Israeli crimes, describing its decision as a major development. Different international human rights organizations have also reacted, with Amnesty International calling the decision a long overdue step towards justice for victims. Human Rights Watch also described the ruling as a real hope for victims of serious crimes. Israel, which is not even a member of the ICC, decried the ruling, saying the court is a political body, not a judicial institution. As expected, the U.S. officially opposed the court's decision. Experts say the ruling is a game-changer for Tel Aviv and Washington.
Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, President Biden will face an interesting challenge. I expect that his reaction will be considerably different than Trump's.
The ruling came amid Palestine's call for further scrutiny into the 2014 Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, in which more than 2,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of children, were killed. 6 years ago, the office of the court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, began a preliminary investigation of Israeli actions in Gaza. In 2019, Bensouda announced that there was a reasonable basis for opening an investigation into the Gaza war and the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Ironically, Israel has continued its crimes against the Palestinians and its expansionist agenda, including illegal settlement activities with the tacit support of the United States and in defiance of UN resolutions. International rights groups have long raised the alarm about Israeli atrocities. Last year, the UN also said that Tel Aviv's excessive force against Palestinians holding weekly anti-occupation rallies may amount to war crimes. The latest ICC ruling has dealt a severe blow to Israel, but will the Palestinians get the justice for crimes they have endured for decades remains to be open.
There are many EU legislators who depict Russia as a dangerous adversary that needs to be restrained. They condemn the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the handling of protests in Russia.
The European Union needs to send a message by not only considering new sanctions, but also by increasing our support to prosecuted, tortured, and repressed voices of the opposition and the civil society.
It's rarely highlighted by mainstream media in the West that Navalny received a prison sentence last month after returning to Russia for breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. Also, Western media never mentioned the global pandemic when reporting on public protests in Russia organized by Navalny supporters. Just last weekend, 500 protesters were arrested here in Brussels, and those detained made claims of police brutality. Mainstream media vilify demonstrators here and in other Western nations for breaking COVID-19 rules, while at the same time portraying protesters in Russia as heroes. The EU and US accused the Russian government of poisoning Alexei Navalny last August. Navalny was treated in Germany after the alleged murder attempt. The Kremlin denies any role and is clearly unhappy that EU authorities refuse to provide medical evidence.
It is quite impolite, mildly speaking, and it is such arrogance from cultural Europe. It seems to me unacceptable, and we categorically reject it.
There are many reasons why Brussels should try to improve relations with Moscow, some EU lawmakers insist.
Well, Russia is a capital neighbor. We cannot ignore that the longest neighbor, the longest border, it is with Russia. Russia is not only, an energy supplier. It's as well a strategic relation.
A good case in point, a number of EU nations are now scrambling to get their hands on Russia's Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, which is more than 90% efficacious. The EU has major vaccine supply issues. Moscow says it's happy to help. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months, but we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir. Where tensions continue to increase, there is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Boazaji University continue protesting the appointment of AKP-affiliated rector. University academics turned their back to the newly appointed rector's office as a symbol of objection. The academics called for the resignation of Melih Bulu, the rector that was appointed by Turkish president. Protests have been going for weeks now, with police arresting hundreds. Demonstrations broke out early January when Turkish president appointed Melih Bulu, an academic with strong ties with the ruling party, as the new rector for Boğaziçi University. Students and academics complained that the appointment broke a decade-long tradition of Boğaziçi rectors being elected from within the university academic team. The Boğaziçi crisis gathered support from other universities and oppositions, who saw in this new trial from the president to force control over the country after granting himself sweeping powers post-coup attempt in 2016. Erdogan said the protests are not led by students, claiming it is stemmed by opposition parties.
A segment of politics is leading the way for this. It is not possible to describe and accept the protests as incidents about the university students. Turkey's opposition parties, including main opposition, Republican People's Party and E Party, as well as People's Democratic Party, are behind all of this.
Turkish president also slammed the U.S. and France over their reaction to the protest, mentioning the incidents taking place ahead of U.S. elections and calling on French President Macron to take care of the yellow vest protests in his country before pointing fingers to what is happening in Turkey. Erdogan argued that the law grants the president the authority to appoint rectors and that he had done it before in other universities.
The whole issue broke out after president appointed the new rector. This is not against the law, but the problem is that Melih Blue isn't an academic and this is against the law. I disagree that the protests were driven by political parties. It started by students. Of course, opposition parties are taking advantage of the protests to lash out at the president.
The government response to the protest came harsh, as peaceful protests have been met with overwhelming violence and arrests. Critics and human rights activists say those are efforts by Erdogan to seize more power using the coup plot as a scarecrow. The Boğaziçi protest brings to mind the huge Gezi Park protest held years ago, with many saying that it will continue because the problem is in the system itself. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S. guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
The Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dueling economic powers have been in loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling. Not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind.
Jobs and working conditions are much more in danger today than in normal times. That's why the main French trade unions called for a nationwide strike and demonstrations in order to defend jobs, salaries, and working conditions. The COVID crisis is leading to an important loss of jobs and to an explosion of poverty. Trade union leaders call for a social spring.
The social spring is a formula we use to say that social question cannot be denied in this difficult period. So the anger we notice every day in the enterprises should find an expression. We want our demands to be heard.
These workers of the big French multinational Total are threatened with dismissal, despite financial support from the state. Other big companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government, but that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China, and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with the pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profits without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many. It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bahtizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, Bahre ehyaye haq jan fada, Kaz patre, patre ye
sanctions impetus to make great breakthroughs. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the 8th day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. The U.S., as the enemy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has left no stone unturned to overthrow the Islamic system. One of the methods that Washington has used since the very foundation of the Islamic system is economic sanction, which has been intensified since a few years ago. These sanctions have been divided in four categories, namely UN Security Council sanctions, EU sanctions, unilateral sanctions by different regimes such as the US and the US Congress sanctions, but they have all been orchestrated by the US. Although the sanctions have reduced Iran's economic and industrial growth to some extent and have restricted foreign investment in Iran, they have multiplied the motive of the Iranian men and women for cutting the country's dependence on abroad. Sanctions have caused troubles, but they have taught the Iranian people to stand on their own feet and rely on their own capacities and capabilities to make progress and achieve lofty goals. This belief has led to eye-catching breakthroughs in a variety of spheres like military, medicine, space, and so on. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on this, "The enemies created so many restrictions against our country. In all economic fields, they were after forging sanction, and they intended to bring the Iranian nation to their knees and the Islamic system to its knees. But the Islamic Republic system, with the help of you people's patience and insight, brought all those policies and policymakers to their knees. We managed to turn these very sanctions into opportunity. These very hurdles, sanctions, and restrictions caused us to gain progresses in the domains of innovation and creativity in all these fields, which the regional countries have not been able to gain through long years. The manufacturing of Omid satellites and putting it into orbit, gaining access to genetic cloning know-how, sciences of stem cells and umbilical cord blood, making state-of-the-art military equipment, especially various pinpoint missiles, achieving nuclear fuel cycle, transplantation of different bodily organs, particularly heart, and nanotechnology are the prominent advancements of the Islamic Iran in the past years. Moreover, it was announced last week that Iran is going to send human beings to the space in 2031. In many of the mentioned spheres, Iran ranks among the 10 countries. Iran has gained spectacular achievements by its researchers who have bravely and indefatigably striven to break the borders of various sciences. The role of some of these great men and women has been manifested especially during the coronavirus outbreak. Nanotechnology helped the Iranian scientists to produce health and hygiene items such as face masks and ventilators inside the country. Furthermore, Iranian scientists have achieved great successes in making the coronavirus vaccine and have entered the human trial phase since late December. According to the latest reports, the head of the National Nanotechnology Headquarters said that Iran published over 12,000 articles on nanotechnology in 2019 to promote its ranking from 57 to 4 in the world. Now, Iran has become one of the seven nations that determine nano standards in the world. Moreover, our scientists have patented 260 inventions in 2019 on nanotechnology, while the number was 2 in 2001. This includes 24% of the global patents in the field. Meanwhile, Iran has made very great achievements in military equipment and weaponry. However, Iran has time and again announced that these achievements are only for defensive purposes and will just be used to deter would-be enemies. Just recently, the Islamic Republic armed forces held 10 war games in 15 days using ballistic missiles and a big variety of weapons and ammunition. The latest news on nuclear technology is that Iran is keen on making metal uranium from natural uranium. Iran's representative to the Vienna-based UN organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that research for designing the enhanced type of fuel for Tehran Research Reactor and this activity will be carried out in three phases. Production of metal uranium from natural uranium is the first phase. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Sanction is definitely curable, but its cure is not retreat. The cure for sanction is merely limited to relying on national abilities. We should keep whatever we have of these abilities. To seek to find new abilities, but surely we have a lot of abilities. Rely on them and revive them. Bring our youth into the field and pursue the principles of resistance economy."
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Iran will return to its commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action if the United States first lifts all sanctions, not on paper, but in actuality. That is according to the leader of Iran's revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He says that the U.S. and its three Western signatories of the agreement are in no place to make demands because they did not abide by their commitments to begin with. U.S. President Joe Biden has now announced that his country will not lift sanctions on Iran unless Iran backs off its enrichment of uranium. Well, stay with us as we take a look at the latest in the saga of the JCPOA drama on this debate.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the country will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only if the United States lifts all its sanctions first. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, is the name of the nuclear deal Iran clinched in 2015 with world powers, including the U.S. But America withdrew from the accord under former President Donald Trump and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. Now, the new president, Joe Biden, says the U.S. will return to the deal, but Iran must first return to full compliance. Iran rejects this, arguing that it was the U.S. that exited the accord and breached its commitments. Ayatollah Khamenei says it is the definitive and irreversible policy of Iran that the U.S. should first lift its sanctions. The leader also says that it's Iran that has the right to set conditions on the nuclear deal, as it has fulfilled all its commitments under the agreement. The leader's comments follow calls by some Western countries to renegotiate the Iran deal, and expand it beyond its nuclear program.
But I do believe that we do need to finalize indeed a new negotiation with Iran, and President Biden has a critical role. We have to address as well the ballistic missiles issues, and we have to address the stability of the region, and this comprehensive agenda is to be negotiated now.
Iran has time and again stressed that the JCPOA is non-negotiable. The country rolled back some of its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after the U.S. pullout. Iran did so after the European countries in the JCPOA, namely France, Britain and Germany, failed to make up for the U.S. withdrawal. Tehran has repeatedly said its rolling back measures are fully reversible once other parties fulfill their commitments. Iran says the ball is now in U.S. court. It says President Biden should now decide on whether to continue the policies of his predecessor or choose a new path. Those policies by Trump under his so-called maximum pressure campaign have already been described as a failure even by some of Washington's closest allies.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Elijah Magdi, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels, and Tohid Asadi, academic and Iranian affairs analyst out of Tehran. Thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start this off with Elijah. Why would there be expectations for Iran to make the first move when Iran did not leave the JCPOA and only scaled up its uranium enrichment years after the U.S. left the deal and when other signatories did not implement their side of the agreement?
I think it's a question of who gives up first on its right. And in this way, here today, we have the Americans who pulled out, and the Iranians cannot trust the U.S. administration. But the most important thing, what Sayyid Khamenei said today, is not repeating the same thing that was said in the last month, that it is up to the Americans to prove their commitment and their compliance and their respect the deal that they came out from. What is the most important, what he said, is if they want Iran to return, the U.S. must lift all sanctions, but we will verify. And if it is done properly, we will return to our commitment. Now, that is the most important part. It's because Iran doesn't trust the Americans, and Biden can say, okay, we're returning, now you go back and stand back on all the steps that you've taken. But that's not enough, because even in 2015, when Barack Obama signed the deal, he did not lift all sanctions. He did not apply all the deal that he himself signed, and all the European companies were hesitant in a striking deal with Iran because the sanctions were not lifted on all banks. That means even if the U.S. said tomorrow, okay, we accept to make the first step and we will respect the deal, then Iran will not jump in and say, okay, we pull back on all the steps. Iran needs to wait and see if the American administration is going to be truthful, which I doubt, because the difference between Obama and Trump and Biden today is not very big. It's just only how vocal is the president, mm-hmm. and the commitment is always the same.
Okay.
The U.S. administration has no interest in seeing Iran strong.
Well, Tohid, what about what Elijah has said? What would be the problem? I mean, Iran, as you know, said today that there is no other way for it to abide by its commitments unless the sanctions are totally lifted off of Tehran first. Now, what exactly is wrong with that demand? Because we have seen now, we've heard from the U.S. administration saying something different.
Well, basically, Biden and his administration have been trying to pretend that they are different from the previous administration. But the thing is that the patterns and the trajectories of foreign policies followed by two administrations are, in a sense, similar, and it gives a very negative signal to Iran. Getting back to your question, I think it's not really the matter of who takes the first step, because the two sides of the story are not really in the same under the same circumstances. Seeing the fact that the United States was the country that started to withdraw from the deal basically in a very unilateral way and with no logical reason behind. So all in all, I think Iran has been always open for any kind of talks and negotiations. But on the other hand, Iran has got this very failed experience of going through the trajectory of negotiations, not only for the process which resulted in JCPOA, but also over the past four decades. And whenever Tehran has tried this path of talks, the outcome from the Western side has been a lack of commitment, and the lack of lack of trust resulted by this lack of commitment. What we hear today from Iran's supreme leader could be very much summarized in one single sentence, and that is Iran's only requirement and Iran's only, let's say, request is one single word, which is commitment. And so far, we have not seen this commitment, basically not from the United States and not from the European Union, with just a little bit of difference that the EU countries try to pretend that they are trying to do something with just putting out some nice words, some verbal statements, but nothing in practice. And the United States was almost clear from the day one when Trump, let's say, took the office. So Iran's tendency to start negotiations with the West is, I think, heavily influenced by a number of actually preventing determinants, including lack of trust, which has got some historical and contemporary sources. And it is also negatively affected by the stated recent, let's say, statements by U.S. Administration officials, including U.S. Secretary of State Blinken. Just I wanted to add one sentence, if I may. A couple of days ago, Blinken said that Iran is weeks away from making a nuclear bomb. It's very much surprising. First of all, you know, we have heard this sentence for more than 5 years. So the basic question is, how many weeks are we away from making a bomb, according to this rhetoric?
Okay.
And then this is not a kind of rhetoric that people usually use when they want to start negotiations. This
indeed. Stay with me, Tohit. Let me get Elijah back in on this discussion. Elijah, what is the problem? It seems that it's difficult for these Western countries to make a commitment and to stick with a commitment or agreement. And it appears, as our previous guest said, it's not just the United States, because, of course, the U.S. left the deal completely, but we also saw the European signatories to the deal basically not keeping their side of the bargain either.
Well, there are many points. Above all, to start with, we used to think that we in Europe here, we have something that is called the law, and that Europe respects the law. And we saw during the Trump administration that the international law is constantly violated, and Europe has been part of it. So first of all, there is no respect of the international law. Secondly, there is no trust in between the parties. Since 1979, Iran is on sanction. It's only because Iran is not submitted to the U.S. hegemony. If Iran tomorrow say, we and the Americans are friends, we have no problem with Israel, and we're not going to support the oppressed organization of group or countries around the world, then Iran can dominate the whole Middle East. So today there is a question of no submission, there is no trust. In the West, they still believe, particularly in America, that Iran is negotiating on selling carpets, and it's possible to negotiate and renegotiate the deal. They just can't understand that the deal was signed after years of negotiation, and that's it, take it or leave it. And because in the West, they made the first step to revoke it, just they throw out of the window all the international law, the UN Resolution 2231, and now Biden is saying, well, we revoked the deal, but you have to return first. But what's the guarantee? There is no guarantee. Then who can guarantee to Iran that another president, if Biden returned to the JCPOA, that another president like Trump would say, no, I don't like the deal and I want to change it. There are no guarantees because there is no international law that is respected. And international, we see even the Americans putting judges of the international court on sanction. So everything is permitted in the rule of the jungle. There is no trust. That is the problem.
Well, what about that, Tohid? There is no trust. I mean, why is it that Western countries seem to think that other countries must abide by their will and not the reverse of this? What are the roots of that? What do you make of it?
As your previous guest said, I think in the Europe there is one concept, and that is law. But at the same time, there is this dichotomy of law versus pressure. And if you just take a look at the huge amount of money that exists in transatlantic relations, you would easily understand how influential the United States would be when it comes to implementation of its foreign policy and forcing European countries. So what we have seen so far is the United States brutally forcing its partners to implement some irrelevant, let's say, foreign policy behaviors. And this, at the same time, the United States, specifically during the 4 years of Trump administration, proved that it is good at one job, and that is breach of international agreements. And this is basically not really related to Iran only, but also it contains a wide range of other international agreements that the United States withdraw all of a sudden with no reason. So at the time being, I think United States has got this really big crisis of lack of trust, not only among the international community, but also among its own, let's say, strategic partners, including some close partners like Germany, like France, like Britain and other countries. So in such a situation, I think when it comes to the case of Iran, they should have a really, let's say, tangible and, let's say, realistic understanding of how things work. And under the current circumstances, I think any kind of miscalculation would result in a disastrous, dramatic situation. So Iran's, first of all, Iran has been practicing patience over the past 5 years, and we know that for this patience, there is a limit. For part of these 5 years, I could say some 3 or 4 years, Iran has got full implementation of JCPOA with nothing in return from the Western side. Mm-hmm. And for some other years, we have just a gradual step back from the deal, again in accordance with JCPOA, okay, not outside of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Elijah, now Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that Iran will not return to the negotiating table to talk about the 2015 nuclear deal. The deal has been reached and agreed upon, and now the U.S. must implement its side of the deal if it returns, meaning the lifting of all sanctions on Iran. So where does that leave the situation in your perspective? You've heard what the leader of the revolution has said, and also now the foreign minister is saying on the Iranian side, and now we've also heard from the American side. Where do you see this going?
We heard what Emmanuel Macron said, the president of France, when he's siding by the Americans and changing also the language, which means France was one of the signatories of the JCPOA in 2015, and now Macron is saying that he wants the Saudis and other friends to join in. So he means the Saudis and the Israelis, which is impossible, because the deal was not signed with in the presence of these two. And also, he's talking about the missiles of Iran, and again, is impossible because they are part of the national security of Iran. So altering the JCPOA is off the table for Iran once for good, and it seems the Americans and the French and the German also are just not getting it. They just don't understand that they cannot negotiate, because they believe Iran is weak, because Iran has been under very harsh sanctions since Trump arrived to power, particularly since 2018. And these harsh sanctions, the Americans and the Europeans, above all, are saying we're not in a hurry. So it's Iran that is feeling the pain, and why we should relieve it, why we should relieve Iran from this pain if we can negotiate a better deal, particularly now that we see Iran's capability. So we again see that the Europe more or less doesn't have a will power. It doesn't have a decision per se. When the, as your guest rightly said, when the American decided something, the German showed some sign of rebellion, Trump said, I'm going to put 25% taxes on all your products coming in the US. So they have to submit immediately for the sake of their economy. So really the Europeans just follow the US policy.
Okay. Well, Tohid, Iran is in the middle of celebrating the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. At the end of the day, do you see the real problem between Iran and some of these Western countries? Basically, is the actual existence of the Islamic Republic and that the Islamic Republic choose to be independent, and these countries have never really come to term with that?
Yeah. Just one follow-up to what your other guest said related to JCPOA, and then I'll be right back to your question. Well, just a quick check into history. Let's just remember that JCPOA was signed and sealed after rounds of negotiations and months of talks. So all the signatories of the deal were in a kind of consensus to limit the scope of the deal and limit the scope of negotiations to one single issue, and that was nuclear issue of Iran, nuclear peaceful program of the of Iranian country and the Iranian nation, basically. So people there were almost the same people that are already in the administration of Joe Biden. And the thing is that now they're talking about broadening the scope of JCPOA, which was already agreed to be limited on a one specific issue. And now they're trying to, I think, make the situation more and more complicated.
Okay.
Sorry for this long follow-up.
Can you address the other question? Because I only have one minute left.
Yeah.
Only a minute.
Okay, you got it.
Go.
I think the big problem is that Iran is a country that over the past four decades has not agreed to, let's say, kind of accept the hegemony of the United States and the West, and has tried to stick to its independent approach and not to get into harmony with this hegemony that has been forced by the United States and its Western partners. And basically, perhaps this is the very key reason behind the current situation and behind the rancorous approach that the United States has taken towards Iran.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this debate. Elijah Magni, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels, and Tohid Asadi, academic and Iranian affairs expert out of Tehran. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzieh Hashimi. Appreciate you joining us, and make sure you join us same time next time.